TIMAUS, given that this is so, we must agree that there is, first, a kind that keeps the same form always, ungenerated and indestructible, neither receiving into itself anything else from elsewhere nor itself passing into anything else anywhere, invisible and otherwise imperceptible. This is the very thing that understanding has been allotted to study. Second, there is that which bears the same name and is like the first, but is perceptible, generated, forever in motion, coming to be in some place and again perishing out of it, apprehended by opinion joined with perception. And third, there is again another kind, that of space, which is everlasting, admits no destruction, provides a seat for all things that come to be, and is itself apprehended without perception, by a kind of bastard reasoning, scarcely to be trusted, the very thing we look to when we dream and say that everything that exists must of necessity be somewhere, in some place, occupying some space, and that what is neither on earth nor anywhere in the heavens is nothing at all. Because of this dreaming state, we are unable, once roused, to draw the necessary distinctions and speak the truth about all these things and their kin, with respect to the waking and truly existing nature, namely, that for an image, since the very thing on which its coming to be depends is not its own, but it is forever borne along as the phantom of something else, it is fitting that it should come to be in something else, clinging in some way to existence, or else be nothing at all. Whereas for that which really and truly is, the exact and true account comes to its aid, namely that so long as one thing is one thing and another is another, neither of the two, having come to be in the other, can ever become one and the same thing while also being two. This account, then, reckoned by my own vote, let it stand given in summary, that being, space, and becoming existed, three things in three ways, even before the heaven came to be. And the nurse of becoming, being made now watery and now fiery, and taking on in turn the shapes of earth and of air, and undergoing all the other affections that attend upon these, appeared many-shaped to look upon. Yet because it was filled with powers neither alike, nor evenly balanced, no part of it was in equilibrium, but it was shaken unevenly in every direction and swayed, and being moved it in turn shook those things. TIMAUS, and the things thus moved were carried, ever separating, this way and that, just as things shaken and winnowed by sieves and instruments used for cleaning grain settle, the dense and heavy ones in one place, the loose and light ones borne off to settle in another spot. In just this way, the four kinds were then shaken by the receiving thing, which itself, being in motion, provided a kind of shaking like that of an instrument, and the things most unlike one another it separated furthest apart, while the things most alike it pressed together most closely into the same place, which is why these kinds came to occupy different regions, even before the ordered whole was formed out of them and came to be. Before that, all these things were in a condition without proportion or measure, but when the ordering of the universe was undertaken, fire and water and earth and air, though they still bore certain traces of themselves, were nevertheless disposed just as one would expect anything to be when God is absent from it. So disposed then by their nature, these things were first given shape by means of forms and numbers. That the God composed them to be as beautiful and as good as possible out of things that were not so disposed, let this stand throughout as something always assumed on our part. Now then, we must attempt to explain to you the ordering and coming to be of each of these, in an account unfamiliar to you. But since you have shared in the paths of learning through which what is said must necessarily be shown, you will follow along. First, then, it is surely plain to everyone that fire, earth, water, and air are bodies, and body in every form possesses depth as well. And depth, in turn, must of necessity be bounded by a plane surface, and every rectilinear plane surface is composed of triangles. All triangles derive from two triangles, each having one right angle and the other angles acute. Of these, one has, on each side, a portion of a right angle divided into equal parts, while the other has unequal parts of it divided unequally. This, then, we lay down as the starting point of fire and of the other bodies, proceeding according to the account that combines likelihood with necessity, But the starting points prior to these are known to God, and to whatever man is dear to him. Now we must say what the four most beautiful bodies would be, unlike one another, yet capable, by breaking down, of arising out of one another. For if we hit upon this, we shall have the truth about the coming to be of earth and fire, and those in proportion between them. For we shall concede to no one that there are visible bodies more beautiful than these, each belonging to a single kind of its own. This then we must be eager to do, to fit together the four kinds of bodies that excel in beauty, and to affirm that we have grasped their nature sufficiently. TIMAUS, of the two triangles, the isosceles has but one form, while the scalene has an unlimited number. So of these unlimited ones, we must choose the most beautiful if we are to begin in the proper way. If anyone can name a more beautiful one, chosen for constructing these bodies, his victory will be that of a friend, not an enemy. But we shall take, then, as the most beautiful of the many triangles, setting aside all the others, the one single triangle out of which the equilateral triangle is composed as a third stage. Why this is so is a longer story, but for whoever tests this claim and discovers that it is indeed so, a friendly prize awaits. Let there be chosen, then, two triangles, out of which the body of fire and the bodies of the other things have been fashioned, the one isosceles, the other having its longer side always three times the square of the shorter, in respect of power. Now what was said earlier, rather unclearly, must be made more precise. For the four kinds appeared to come to be out of one another through one another, all of them, but this appearance is not correct. For four kinds do indeed come to be out of the triangles we have chosen, three of them from the one triangle that has unequal sides, and the fourth, alone, fitted together, out of the isosceles triangle. So it is not possible for all of them, breaking apart into one another, to turn a few large ones into many small ones and the reverse, but three of them can. For since all three are naturally composed from a single triangle, when the larger ones are broken up, many small ones will be formed out of the same triangles, taking on the shapes proper to themselves. And again, when many small ones are scattered apart along their triangles, a single number of them, forming one mass, will produce one large unit of another kind. So much, then, for their coming to be out of one another. Next, it would follow to speak of what shape each of them has come to be, and out of what combination of numbers. The first kind, and the smallest to be composed, will lead the way. Its element is the triangle whose hypotenuse is twice the length of its shorter side. When two such triangles are joined along their diagonal, and this is done three times, with the diagonals and the short sides all set together at a single point as a center, one equilateral triangle is formed out of six such triangles in number. Four equilateral triangles, joined three plane angles at a time, make one solid angle, the one formed next in order after the most obtuse of the plane angles. When four such angles have been completed, the first solid figure results, one that divides the whole sphere into equal and similar parts. The second solid comes from the same triangles, but eight equilateral triangles uniting so that four plane angles yield a single solid one. And when six such angles have been formed, the second body is likewise complete. The third is put together out of 120 of the elements, with 12 solid angles, each contained by five equilateral plane triangles, and it has 20 faces, each an equilateral triangle. And at this point, one of the two elements was done generating these bodies, while the isosceles triangle went on to generate the nature of the fourth. Four of them joined together, bringing their right angles to a common center, produce a single equilateral quadrilateral. Six of these joined together produce eight solid angles, each fitted together out of three plane right angles, and the shape of the resulting body has become the cube, having six plane equilateral quadrilateral faces. There remained one further construction, a fifth, and the god used it for the universe as a whole, embroidering it upon that. Now if someone, weighing all this carefully, were to raise the question whether the number of worlds should be said to be unlimited or finite, he would judge the view that they are unlimited to be really the opinion of someone inexperienced in matters where experience is called for. But whether it is proper to say there is truly by nature one such world, or five, is a question over which one might more reasonably come to a halt and feel at a loss. Our own account declares that by the likely reasoning there is by nature one God of this kind, but another, looking to other considerations, will judge otherwise. This question we must let go, and let us now assign the kinds that have arisen in our discussion to fire, earth, water, and air. To earth let us give the cubic form, for earth is the most immobile of the four kinds and the most malleable of bodies, and that which has the most secure bases must of necessity be preeminently of this character. And among the triangles we posited at the outset, the base formed of equal sides is by nature more secure than that of unequal sides, and the plane composed of each, the equilateral quadrilateral built from equilateral triangles, stands, both in its parts and as a whole, more firmly than the triangle does, of necessity. For this reason, in assigning this figure to earth, we preserve the likely account, and to water, in turn, we assign the least mobile of the remaining forms, to fire the most mobile, and to air the form in between, and the smallest body to fire, the largest to water, and the one in between to air, and again the sharpest to fire, the second to air, the third to water. Now of all these, the one having the fewest bases must by nature be the most mobile, being in every way the most cutting and sharp of all, and moreover the lightest, being composed of the fewest identical parts. The second is second in having these same properties, and the third is third. Let it stand then, according to the correct and likely account, that the solid figure that has come to be in the form of the pyramid is fire's element and its seed. And let us say that the second in order of generation is that of air, the third that of water. All of these we must think of as so small that no single one of any kind is visible to us because of its smallness, though when many are gathered together their masses can be seen. And indeed the proportions governing their quantities, their motions, and their other properties, the God everywhere, wherever the nature of necessity yielded willingly and was persuaded, worked out with precision in every respect, and fitted these together in due proportion. From everything we have said about these kinds, the following would be, by likely account, most nearly the case. Earth, on meeting fire and being dissolved by its sharpness, would be carried along, whether it happens to be dissolved in fire itself, or in a mass of air or of water, until its parts, meeting one another somewhere, are refitted again to one another and become earth once more, for into any other kind it could never pass. Water, though once broken up by fire, or indeed by air, admits of recombination so as to form one body of fire and two of air, and the divided fragments of one part of air could become two bodies of fire. And again, whenever a little fire, enclosed by much air or water or some earth, moving among things that are being carried along, struggles and is overcome and shattered, two bodies of fire combine into one form of air. And when air is overpowered and broken up, out of two whole parts and a half, one whole compact form of water will result. For let us reason about these things again in this way. Whenever amid fire some other kind is caught by it, and severed by the keenness of its angles and its edges, then if it recombines into the nature of fire it ceases being cut, for no kind that is alike, and the same as itself can ever produce any change in, or suffer anything from, another kind that is in the same condition and alike to it. But so long as it is passing into something else, being weaker, and struggles against something stronger, it does not cease being dissolved. And again, when smaller particles, enclosed by many larger ones, are shattered, few against many, and quenched, they cease being extinguished only once they consent to combine into the form of what has overpowered them, and fire becomes air, air becomes water. But if in passing into these same forms, Some other kind combining with them should struggle against them. They do not cease being dissolved, until being thoroughly driven and broken apart, they escape to their kindred, or else, being overcome, one out of many becomes like the victor and remains dwelling together with it. And indeed, it is through these very transformations that all things exchange their regions, for the bulk of each kind is set apart in a region of its own because of the motion of the receiving medium, while those parts that become each time unlike themselves and like other things are carried, by the shaking, toward the region of those things to which they have become alike. Now all the unmixed, primary bodies have come to be through such causes as these. But as for the fact that other kinds are found engendered within the forms of these, the cause must be sought in the construction of each of the elements. It was not merely one size of triangle that was planted at the beginning for each, but smaller and larger ones, in a number corresponding to the number of kinds found within the forms. Hence, as they mix with themselves and with one another, the variety is unlimited, and it is this variety that those who intend to give a likely account of nature must study closely. Concerning motion and rest, in what manner and among what conditions they occur, unless one comes to some agreement about this, much will stand in the way of the reasoning that follows. Something has already been said about them, but beyond that there is this further point: motion is never willing to exist in a state of uniformity. For it is difficult, rather impossible, for there to be a thing to be moved without something to move it, or a mover without something to be moved. There is no motion where these are absent, yet it is impossible for these ever to be uniform. Let us then always posit rest as belonging to uniformity, and motion as arising from non-uniformity, and inequality, in turn, is the cause of a non-uniform nature. We have already explained the origin of inequality, but we have not said how it is that things, once separated out by kind, do not cease from their motion and passage through one another. So let us say it again in this way: the revolution of the whole, since it has taken all the kinds together within it, being circular in shape and naturally inclined to gather in upon itself, constricts everything and leaves no empty space anywhere. For this reason, fire has penetrated most thoroughly into everything, air second, since it is by nature second in fineness, and the rest likewise, for the things composed of the largest parts have left the greatest gaps in their structure, the smallest the least. This compacting, then, forces the small into the empty spaces of the large. So with the small placed alongside the large, and the smaller particles separating out the larger, while the larger compress the smaller together, everything is carried up and down toward its own proper region. For as each thing changes in size, it also changes its position in space. In this way, and for these reasons, the generation of non-uniformity is continually preserved, providing the motion of these things that exists now and will exist forever without ceasing. After this, we must understand that many kinds of fire have come to be, flame, for instance, and that which streams off from flame, which does not burn but provides light for our eyes, and that which, once the flame is extinguished, remains behind in what is still glowing hot. Likewise with air, the most translucent kind is called by the name ether, the murkiest is mist and darkness, and there are other nameless forms besides, arising from the inequality of the triangles. As for water, there are first of all two kinds, the liquid and the fusible. The liquid kind, because it partakes of those kinds of water which are small, being unequal, is mobile both of itself and by another, owing to its non-uniformity and the character of its shape. But the kind composed of large and uniform parts is more stable than the former, and being solidified by its uniformity, is heavy. Yet when fire enters and dissolves it, it loses this uniformity, and having lost it, it partakes more of motion, and becoming mobile, pushed by the neighboring air and stretched out over the earth, it takes the name melting for the reduction of its mass, and flowing for its being drawn out over the earth. And again, when the fire departs from it, since it does not go out into a void, the neighboring air, being pushed, forces the still mobile liquid mass into the seats vacated by the fire and mixes it in upon itself. And the liquid, being compressed and regaining its uniformity again, now that the fire, the craftsman of its non-uniformity, has departed, settles back into agreement with itself. And the departure of fire is called cooling, while the coming together that follows fire's withdrawal is called becoming solid. Now of all these that we have called fusible waters, the one that becomes densest, composed of the finest and most uniform parts, a single uniform kind, sharing in a gleaming, golden color, is that most precious possession, gold, refined, and hardened through the rock. The offshoot of gold, being, on account of its density, the hardest of all and having turned dark, is called adamant. And there is another kind, close to gold in its parts, but having more than one form, denser in one respect than gold, and sharing in a small, fine portion of earth so as to be harder, yet lighter because it has large gaps within itself. This, one kind among the bright, solidified waters, when combined, has become bronze. And the portion of earth mixed into it, when with age the two separate again from one another, becomes visible by itself, and is called verdigris. As for the rest of such things, it is no longer anything intricate to work out, if one keeps pursuing the pattern of likely accounts. And whenever, for the sake of relaxation, one sets aside for a while the accounts concerning things that always are, and, in contemplating the likely accounts of things that come to be, gains a pleasure free of regret, one would thereby provide oneself a measured and sensible amusement in life. It is in this spirit that we now, having indulged ourselves, shall go on to trace out what follows next concerning these same matters, in likely fashion, as follows. Water mixed with fire, the sort that is fine and fluid because of its motion and the path along which it rolls upon the earth. It is on this account called liquid, and also soft, because its bases, being less firmly grounded than those of earth, give way. When this is separated from fire and isolated from air as well, it becomes more uniform and is compressed together by the elements departing from it. And having thus solidified, that portion which undergoes this above the earth is called hail, and on the earth, ice, and that which has undergone it less, being still only half solidified, is called, above the earth, snow, and on the earth, when it solidifies out of dew, is called hoarfrost. TIMAUS, as for the many kinds of water mixed with one another, the whole class of them, filtered through the plants that grow from the earth, are called flavors, and because of their mixtures each kind, differing from the others, has given rise to many unnamed varieties, but four of them, being fiery in nature and coming out especially transparent, have received names of their own. The one that warms the soul together with the body is wine, the one that is smooth and separates the sight, and for that reason appears bright and gleaming and oily, is the oil-like kind, pitch, castor oil, olive oil itself, and whatever else has the same power, and whatever has the capacity to dissolve as far as the natural joints around the mouth, providing sweetness by this power, has received the name honey, the term applied most of all among such things. And the kind that dissolves flesh by burning it, a frothy class set apart from all the other flavors, has been named sap. As for the kinds of earth, the earth that is filtered through water becomes, in the following way, a stony body. When the water mixed with it is cut off in the mixing, it changes into the form of air, and having become air, it rushes up to its own place. But since no empty space lay above them, it pushed the neighboring air. That air being heavy, when pushed and poured around the mass of earth, pressed hard upon it, and squeezed it together into the very seats from which the new air was rising. And earth compacted inseparably by air together with water forms rock, more beautiful, the kind whose parts are equal, and even and transparent, uglier, the opposite kind. And whatever has all its moisture snatched away suddenly by the swiftness of fire, and forms into something more brittle than that former kind, becomes the substance we have named earthenware. And sometimes, when moisture is left behind, earth that has become fluid through fire, when it cools, becomes the stone that has a black color. Two other kinds, again formed in the same way out of a mixture with much water, but out of finer parts of earth, and being briny, half-solidified, and yet dissolvable again by water. One is the kind that cleanses oil and earth, soda, the other, the kind well-suited for the sensations that occur in the mouth in social gatherings, is the substance dear to the gods that is salt, in keeping with custom. Those things common to both, not dissolvable by water but by fire, are compounded in this way, for the following reason. Neither fire nor air melts masses of earth, for since their parts are naturally smaller than the interstices in earth's structure, they pass through its ample open spaces without forcing their way, and leave it undissolved, unmelted. But the parts of water, since they are naturally larger, force their way through, and in dissolving the earth, melt it. Times, earth that is not compacted, then, only water dissolves by force in this way. But earth that has been compacted, nothing but fire dissolves, for entry has been left to nothing but fire. And of the combination of water, only fire dissolves the most forcibly bound kind, while both fire and air dissolve the weaker kind, the one working through the interstices, the other even through the triangles themselves. And of air compacted by force, nothing dissolves it except by resolving it into its element, while unforced, only fire melts it down. As for the bodies compounded of earth and water mixed together, so long as the water occupying the interstices of the earth in it, forced together, holds them, the parts of water coming upon it from outside, having no way in, flow around the whole mass and leave it unmelted. But the particles of fire, slipping into the gaps within the water, doing to water what water does to earth, working upon air the way fire itself does, are the sole cause by which the compound body, once melted, comes to flow. Now it happens that some of these bodies have less water than earth. The whole class of glass, and all the kinds called fusible stones, while others have more water, all the bodies that solidify into wax-like and incense-like substances. And so the kinds that have been variegated by shapes, combinations, and mutual transformations have now, more or less, been displayed. But we must try to bring to light the affections belonging to them and the causes through which they have come about. First of all, then, sensation must always be presupposed for what we say, though we have not yet gone through the coming to be of flesh and what belongs to flesh, nor of the mortal part of the soul. And it happens that neither these things can be adequately explained apart from the affections that concern sensation, nor those apart from these, though to explain them together is nearly impossible. We must therefore first assume the one set, and come back afterward to what we have assumed. So that the affections may be discussed in due order after the kinds, let us take as prior to us the things concerning body and soul. First, then, as to why we call fire hot, let us look at it in this way, considering the separating and cutting action it produces upon our body. That the affection is something sharp, nearly all of us perceive. Times, but we must reckon with the fineness of its sides, the sharpness of its angles, the smallness of its parts, and the speed of its motion, by all of which, being forceful and sharp cutting, it always cuts through whatever it meets, recalling the coming to be of its shape, that it is above all that particular nature, and no other that, cutting through our bodies and mincing them into small pieces, has quite reasonably given both the affection and the name we now call heat. The opposite of this is plain enough, but let it not go without an account all the same. For the coarser-parted portions of the moisture surrounding the body, as they make their way in and expel the smaller ones, being unable to slip into their seats, and pressing together our moisture, turning it from uneven, and moving into unmoving through evenness, the compression they produce solidifies it, and what is drawn together contrary to nature fights back according to its own nature, pushing itself in the opposite direction. To this struggle and this shaking has been given the name trembling and shivering, and the whole of this affection, together with what produces it, has been called cold. Hard is whatever our flesh yields to, soft, whatever yields to our flesh, and so also in their relation to one another. What yields is whatever rests on a small base. But what is composed of square bases, being very firmly planted, is the most resistant form, as is whatever, compacted into the greatest density, offers the strongest resistance. Heavy and light would be shown most clearly if examined together, with what is called the nature of down and up. For it is not at all correct to think that there are by nature two regions, dividing the universe in two and opposed to each other, one below, toward which everything that has any bodily mass is carried, and one above, toward which everything moves only unwillingly. For since the whole heaven is spherical, all the points that are equally distant from the center must be alike extremities, and the center, being distant by the same measure from all the extremities, must be thought to lie directly opposite to all of them. Since the cosmos is naturally so constituted, whoever places any of the things just mentioned as up or down would not, in justice, be thought to be speaking a name that fits at all. For the middle region in it is not naturally either down or fittingly called up, but simply in the middle, and the surrounding region is neither the middle, nor does it have any part of itself different from another in being nearer the middle than what lies opposite. And since it is by nature alike in every direction, what names could one apply to it that are opposite to each other, and in any way think one was speaking correctly? TIMAUS, for if there were some solid body evenly balanced at the center of the universe, it would never be carried toward any of the extremities, on account of their being alike in every direction. Rather, even if someone were to travel around it in a circle, he would often, standing at antipodal points, call the very same spot of it both down and up. For the whole, as has just been said, being spherical, it is not the mark of a sensible person to say that it has one region down and another up. As for why these names came to be used, and in what contexts we have grown accustomed to use them, and because of that habit, to speak of the whole heaven as divided in this way, these points we must agree upon, having laid down the following as our assumption. If someone standing in that region of the universe where the nature of fire has its especial seat, and where the greatest amount of it would be gathered, toward which it is carried, if someone, stepping onto that mass and having the power to do so, were to take away parts of the fire, setting them in scale pans, and lifting the balance beam, drag the fire by force into the unlike air, it is clear that the lesser quantity would yield to his force more readily than the greater. For whenever one and the same effort raises a pair of things together, the smaller must necessarily yield to the force and follow along more readily, the larger less so. And so the greater amount would be called heavy, and said to move downward, the smaller, light, and upward. This very same thing we must catch ourselves doing in this region here. For standing on the earth, when we separate out earthy kinds, and sometimes earth itself, we drag them by force and against nature into the unlike air, both clinging to what is akin to them, but the smaller yields more easily than the larger to those exerting the force, and follows first into the unlike medium. And so we have called it light, and the region into which we force it, up, while the opposite affection to these we call heavy and down. These things, then, must necessarily stand in varying relations to one another, because the masses of the various kinds occupy opposite regions, one here and another there. For what is light in one region, being opposite in place to what is light in the opposite region, and heavy to heavy, down to down and up to up, will all be found, on examination, to be opposite, crosswise, and in every way different from one another as they come to be and exist. Yet this one point must be understood concerning all of them, that the path toward what is akin to each is what makes the thing moving heavy, and the region toward which such a thing is carried, down, while things standing otherwise than these behave in the opposite way. So much, then, for the causes of these affections. TIMAUS, as for the affection of smooth and rough, anyone who has grasped its cause could probably explain it to another as well. For hardness mixed with unevenness produces roughness, while evenness combined with density produces smoothness. The greatest of the affections shared by the body as a whole still remains, It is the cause of pleasant and painful sensations in the things we have gone through, and all the sensations that, through the parts of the body, involve pains, and following upon them, pleasures at the same time. Let us then take up the causes of every affection, whether perceptible or imperceptible, in the following way, recalling what we distinguished earlier about the nature of what is easily moved and what is not easily moved. For it is along these lines that we must pursue everything we intend to grasp. For whatever is by nature easily moved, when even a slight affection falls upon it, transmits it in a circle, one part acting upon another in the same way, until the parts reach the seat of intelligence and report the power of what produced it. Whereas the opposite kind, being stable and moving in no circle, only suffers the affection itself and moves nothing else nearby, so that, the parts not transmitting the affection to one another, the initial affection, remaining unmoved in them, produces insensibility in the living creature as a whole, with respect to what it has undergone. This is the case with the bones and the hair, and whatever other parts we have in us that are for the most part earthy, whereas what was said before applies especially to sight and hearing, because in them the power of fire and air is present in the greatest degree. Now pleasure and pain must be understood in this way. An affection that arises among us contrary to nature and all at once, and is violent, is painful, while what departs again all at once toward its natural state is pleasant, but what is gentle and gradual is imperceptible, and the opposite of these is opposite. And whatever comes about with ease is entirely perceptible in the highest degree, but has no share of pain or pleasure, such as the affections concerning sight itself, which was said earlier to be a body that becomes joined to us daily. For in this case, cuttings and burnings, and whatever else it undergoes produce no pains, nor again pleasures when it returns to the same form. But the sensations are greatest and clearest according to whatever it undergoes, and whatever things it comes into contact with by directing itself toward them in any way, for there is no force at all in its separation and combination. Bodies made of larger parts yield only grudgingly to what acts on them, but transmit the motion through the whole, and so they produce pleasures and pains when they are thrown out of their own state, pleasures when they are restored again to it. But whatever has taken on its withdrawals and emptyings little by little, and its fillings all at once and on a large scale, is insensible to the emptying but keenly sensitive to the filling. Such things bring the mortal part of the soul no pains, but the greatest pleasures, as is plain in the case of sweet smells. Whatever, on the other hand, is estranged all at once, but returns to its own state again only slowly and by degrees, produces effects the very opposite of the former, as shows itself plainly when the body suffers burning or cutting. Now we have pretty well described the affections common to the whole body, and the names that have arisen for the agents that produce them. We must try to describe, so far as we can, what occurs in our several parts individually, both the affections themselves and, in turn, the causes of the agents that produce them. First, then, we must try to bring to light, as far as possible, the matters concerning flavors that we left aside earlier, affections peculiar to the tongue. These two, it appears, like most things, come about through certain combinations and separations, and beyond that they make use, more than the other senses do, of roughness and smoothness. Whatever particles enter around the little veins that stretch, as it were like sampling probes of the tongue, toward the heart, and fall upon the moist and soft parts of the flesh, and in dissolving draw the little veins together and dry them out, these, if rather rough, appear astringent, and if less rough, appear merely tart. And those substances that scour these away and rinse off the whole area of the tongue, if they do this beyond due measure and go so far as to erode its very substance, like the power of soda, are all called bitter, while those that fall short of the soda-like condition and use their scouring power in moderation appear to us salty, without harsh bitterness, and rather agreeable. Substances that share in the heat of the mouth and are smoothed by it, catching fire together with it, and then in turn burning back against the very thing that heated them, and being carried upward by their lightness to the sensations of the head, and cutting through everything they fall upon. Because of these powers, all such things are called pungent. And again, the substance that has been thinned out beforehand by decay, and works its way into the narrow veins, and there meets earthy parts and parts with a due proportion of air, so that it stirs them and makes them churn about one another, and in churning they collide and working into one another, produce hollow places by stretching around what enters them. When moisture stretches hollow around air, sometimes earthy moisture, sometimes pure, moist vessels of air are formed, round hollow bodies of water. And those formed of the pure moisture, standing round transparent, are called bubbles, while those of the earthy moisture, when it is stirred and rises up together, are called boiling and fermentation, and the cause of these affections is called sour. Opposite to all these described affections is an affection from an opposite cause. Whenever the composition of what enters, being in moist substances naturally suited to the tongue's condition, smooths what has been roughened by spreading over it, and draws together what is unnaturally contracted or, conversely, loosens what is unnaturally dispersed, and settles everything as much as possible into its natural state. Every such thing, being pleasant and welcome to everyone as a remedy for violent affections, is called sweet. So much for that. As for the power of the nostrils, there are no distinct kinds within it. For every smell is a half-formed thing, and no kind possesses the due proportion needed to have any particular smell. Rather, our veins around this region are formed too narrow for the kinds of earth and water, but too wide for those of fire and air, and that is why no one has ever perceived any smell of these. Smells arise instead only when things are wetted, or decaying, or melting, or being burned as incense. For as water changes into air and air into water, smells come to be in the interval between these, and all smells are a kind of smoke or mist, that which passes from air into water being mist, and that which passes from water into air being smoke. Hence all smells are finer than water, but coarser than air. This becomes clear whenever, something obstructing the breath, one draws the air into oneself by force, for then no smell is filtered through together with it, but the air, stripped of all smells, follows alone. So these varied forms of smell have received two names only, not being drawn from many or simple kinds, but rather only the pleasant and the painful stand out distinctly as named here, one being that which roughens and does violence to the whole cavity that lies between our head and navel, the other being that which soothes this same region and restores it gladly to its natural state. Considering next the third perceptive part within us, that concerned with hearing, we must state the causes that produce the affections connected with it. Let us in general lay down that sound is a blow transmitted through the ears, by means of air, brain, and blood, all the way to the soul, and that the motion caused by it, beginning at the head and ending in the region of the liver, is hearing, and that whatever motion is swift is high-pitched, and whatever is slower is lower-pitched, and that motion which is uniform is even and smooth, while its opposite is rough, and that a large motion is loud, while its opposite is soft. The matters concerning their concords must necessarily be treated later on. There remains for us now a fourth kind of perception, which we must distinguish, since it comprises many varied forms within itself, all of which together we have called colors, a flame streaming off from the bodies of each thing, having particles proportioned to sight so as to produce sensation. The causes of the origin of sight itself were stated earlier. It is fitting, then, that here we should go through the subject of colors in a reasonable account of this kind, of the particles that stream from other things and fall upon sight. Some are smaller, some larger, and some equal to the parts of sight itself. Those that are equal are imperceptible, and these we call transparent, while those that are larger or smaller, the ones contracting sight, the others expanding it, are akin to the hot and cold affecting the flesh, and to the astringent affecting the tongue, and to all those heat-producing things we called pungent. These are white and black, being the same affections in a different kind, though appearing different because of these different causes. So they must be named accordingly. That which dilates sight is white, and its opposite is black. While the swifter motion, belonging to a different kind of fire, falling upon and dilating sight all the way to the eyes, and forcing apart and dissolving the very passages of the eyes, pouring out from their fire all at once together with water, which we call a tear, being itself fire meeting fire from the opposite direction, and as the fire that leaps out flashes like lightning, while that which enters is quenched in the moisture, all sorts of colors arise in this churning. This affection we have called shimmering. And that which produces it, we have named bright and gleaming. A kind of fire midway between these, reaching the moisture of the eyes and mingling with it, but not gleaming. When the ray of this fire mingles through the moisture and produces a blood-red color, we call this name red. And bright, mingled with red and white, becomes yellow. But as for the proportion in which each is mingled, even if one knew it, it would make no sense to state it, since for such things one could give neither any necessity nor any reasonably probable account with real precision. Red mixed with black and white gives purple, and dusky, when these are mixed together and burned more, and black is mingled further in. Tawny comes from a mixture of yellow and gray from white and black, and pale yellow from white mixed with yellow. White combined with bright and falling into deep black produces the color dark blue, and dark blue mixed with white gives gray blue, and tawny mixed with black gives greenish. The rest are fairly evident from these, by whatever mixtures one might preserve their likeness in the probable account. But if anyone should put these matters to an actual test, he would show ignorance of the difference between human and divine nature, that a god possesses both the skill and the power to fuse plurality into a single unity, and likewise to break that unity back apart into many things, whereas no human being either is now, or ever will be in the future, capable of either of these two things. All these matters, then, being at that time of such a nature by necessity, the craftsmen of the fairest and best took them over as they occurred in the process of becoming, when he was engendering the self-sufficient and most perfect God, making use of the causes concerned with them as his servants, but himself fashioning the good in everything that came to be. This is why we must distinguish two kinds of cause, the necessary and the divine, and seek the divine in everything, for the sake of acquiring a life of happiness, so far as our nature allows it, while seeking the necessary for the sake of the divine, reckoning that without these we cannot, by themselves, either understand or grasp, or in any other way share in those very things toward which we are in earnest. Now, since the kinds of causes lie before us, filtered out, like timber laid ready for carpenters, out of which the remaining account must be woven together, let us go back again briefly to the beginning and move quickly to the same point from which we arrived here, and then try to set upon what has gone before a conclusion and a head fitting to the tale. As was said at the very start, these things, existing in disorder, God introduced into each of them, in itself, and in relation to one another, such measures of proportion as it was possible for them to have, so far as they could be made analogous and proportionate. For at that time none of these had any share in such qualities except by chance, nor was there anything worth naming among the things now named, such as fire and water and any of the rest. But God first set all these in order, and then out of them constructed this universe, one single living creature containing within itself all living creatures, both mortal and immortal. Of the divine beings, he himself becomes the craftsman, but the making of the mortal beings he assigned to his own offspring to fashion. And they, imitating him, having received the immortal principle of the soul, fashioned around it a mortal body and gave it the whole body as a vehicle, and built onto it another form of soul, the mortal kind, containing within itself terrible and necessary affections, first pleasure, the greatest incitement to evil, then pains, which drive away good things, and further boldness and fear, foolish counselors both, and anger, hard to appease, and hope, easily led astray. And mingling these with irrational sensation and desire that ventures upon everything, they compounded the mortal kind of soul, as necessity required. And on this account, reverencing to defile the divine part, except so far as was wholly necessary, they gave the mortal part a separate dwelling apart from that other, in a different region of the body, building a neck between them as an isthmus and boundary between head and chest, so that they might be kept apart. It is in the chest, then, and in what is called the trunk, that they bound in the mortal kind of soul. And since one part of the soul was by nature better, the other worse, they built the cavity of the chest as a separate lodging, marking it off the way one marks off women's quarters from men's, placing the midriff between them as a partition. The part of the soul that shares in courage and spirit, being ambitious for victory, they gave a dwelling closer to the head, in the space bounded by the neck above and the midriff below, so that, being obedient to reason, it might join forces with it in forcibly restraining the tribe of appetites whenever they refused, from the citadel above, to submit willingly to the command and reason. As the place where the veins are tied into a knot, and the source out of which blood is pumped forcefully to every limb, the heart they stationed in the guardhouse, so that when the might of spirit boiled up, reason having given the signal that some unjust act was occurring, whether from outside or from the appetites within, every sensitive part of the body might quickly, through all the narrow passages, perceive the summons and the threats, and become obedient and follow throughout. And thus allow the best part to rule over them all. But foreseeing that the heart's leaping in anticipation of dangers and its rousing in anger would all involve such swelling brought on by fire, they contrived aid for it by planting the lung within, first soft and bloodless, then having hollows inside like a sponge pierced through, so that by receiving breath and drink it might cool the heart and provide relief and respite in the heat. For this reason they cut channels of the windpipe toward the lung and set the lung around the heart like a cushion, so that when spirit was at its height within it, the heart, leaping into something yielding and being cooled, might suffer less and be better able to serve reason in company with spirit. As for the part of the soul that desires food and drink, and whatever else it needs because of the nature of the body, this they settled in the region between the midriff and the boundary at the navel, fashioning throughout that whole area a kind of manger for the body's nourishment. And there they tied this thing down like a wild beast, one that must nonetheless be kept fed and joined to us, if a mortal race was ever to exist at all. So that it might always be grazing at its manger, and dwelling as far as possible from the deliberating part, causing the least possible tumult and outcry, and might allow the best part to deliberate in peace about what is advantageous for all in common and for each individually. For this reason, they gave it this position there. And knowing that it would never understand reason, and that even if it should somehow get a share of some perception of such things, it would have no innate concern for any reasoned arguments, but would be led about above all by images and phantoms by night and by day. For this, the god, plotting against it, constructed the form of the liver and placed it in that creature's dwelling, contriving it to be dense and smooth and bright and sweet, yet also possessing bitterness. So that the power of thoughts moving from the mind might, as in a mirror that receives impressions and yields visible images to be seen, at one time frighten this thing when it employs a portion of that bitterness akin to itself, bearing down on it harshly with a threat, mixing itself swiftly through the whole of the liver so as to display bilious colors, and by contracting the whole make it wrinkled and rough, and by bending the lobe and the receptacles and the gates down from their upright position and squeezing them, and by blocking some and closing others, cause pains and nausea. And again, when on the contrary, some breath of gentleness from the thinking part paints the opposite kind of images, giving the bitterness rest by being unwilling to stir or touch a nature opposite to its own, but instead employing toward the liver the sweetness native to it, and setting all its parts straight and smooth and free, it might make the portion of the soul settled around the liver cheerful and content, giving it a measured way of passing the night, engaged in divination in sleep, since it had no share in reason and understanding. For those who put us together, remembering their father's instruction to make the mortal race as good as possible within the limits of power, set right even this base part of us in this way, so that it might somehow lay hold of truth, and for that purpose established the seat of divination in this organ. And there is sufficient proof that God has given divination to human folly, for no one in his right mind lays hold of true, inspired divination, but only when the power of his understanding is fettered in sleep, or he is deranged through disease, or has passed out of himself through some form of possession. But it belongs to a person in his right mind to think over and recall, whether dreaming or waking, the things said by this prophetic and inspired nature, and to sort out by reasoning all the apparitions that were seen, working out in what way, and for whom they signify something of evil or good to come, or past, or present. But it is not the task of one who is still in the grip of madness to judge what has appeared and been spoken by himself. Rather, as the old saying rightly has it, to do and to know one's own affairs and oneself belongs only to the sound of mind. That is why it is the custom to appoint the tribe of prophets as judges over inspired divinations, people some call diviners themselves, in total ignorance that they are interpreters of riddling utterance and vision, and not diviners at all, but most properly to be called prophets of things divined. This, then, is why the liver has the nature it does, and is situated where we say it is, for the sake of divination. And while each living thing is alive, this organ's signs are clearer, but once deprived of life, it goes blind, and its divinations become too dim to signify anything clear. The structure and seat of the neighboring organ came about on the left for the sake of the liver, so as to keep it always bright and clean, like a mirror always standing ready and prepared at its side. This is why, whenever there is some uncleanness about the liver due to bodily illness, the spleen's porous texture, being hollow and bloodless as it is woven, receives and cleanses it all away. And so, filling up with what is purged away, it grows large and festers. And again, when the body is purified, it subsides and shrinks back to its former size. So much, then, for the soul, what part of it is mortal and what divine, and where and with what companions, and for what reasons it was settled apart. That this account is true, we could affirm with confidence only if a God agreed. But that it is likely, as we have said, both now and on further reflection, this we must venture to assert, and let it be asserted. What comes next in order must be pursued in the same manner. It was the remaining part of the body, how it came to be. It would be most fitting for us to put this together out of the following line of reasoning. Those who put together our race knew that we would be undisciplined in drink and food, and that through greed we would consume far more than what is measured and necessary. So that there should not be swift destruction through disease, and the mortal race come to an end straightaway before it was complete. Foreseeing this, they set up what is called the lower belly as a receptacle to hold the surplus of drink and food, and they coiled the formation of the intestines round about, so that the food, passing through too quickly, should not force the body to need further food again too quickly, and by producing insatiable craving make the whole race, through gluttony, unphilosophical and uncultured, disobedient to the most divine part within us. As for bones and flesh, and everything of that nature, matters stood as follows. The origin of all these lies in the generation of marrow, for the bonds of life, by which the soul is bound to the body, are fastened together in this, and take root there for the mortal race, and the marrow itself came to be from other things. Four of the triangles, whichever were first, unwarped and smooth, and most capable of yielding fire and water and air and earth with precision, these the God, separating each from its own kind, and mixing them with one another in due proportion, contriving a seed stock for every mortal kind, made into the marrow, and afterward, planting in it the various kinds of souls, divided the marrow itself, at once in the original distribution, into just as many and such shapes as the souls were going to have severally in their several forms. And the portion which was to hold the divine seed within it, like a field, he shaped round on every side, and called this share of the marrow the brain, since once each living creature was completed, the vessel around this part would become its head. but the part that was to hold the remaining, mortal part of the soul he divided into shapes at once round and elongated, and called all of it marrow alike. And casting out from these, as if from anchors, the bonds of the whole soul, he then fashioned our entire body around this, fitting first a covering of bone all around it. And he put the bone together in this way, sifting earth pure and smooth, he kneaded it and moistened it with marrow, and after this put it into fire, then dipped it into water, then again into fire, and again into water. And by carrying it back and forth many times into each in this way, he made it unmeltable by either. Making use of this, he turned on a lathe, around the brain, a bony sphere, and left in it a narrow passage. For the marrow that runs through neck and backbone, he shaped vertebrae from that same stuff, and slid them beneath it like pivots, beginning from the head, running through the whole trunk. And thus, to preserve the whole seed, he fenced it in with a stone-like enclosure, fashioning joints, employing in them the power of the other as something set in the middle, for the sake of movement and bending. Considering that the condition of bony substance was more brittle and inflexible than it should be, and that becoming heated through and then cooled again, it would quickly mortify and destroy the seed within it. For these reasons he devised the kind of sinews and the kind of flesh, so that by binding all the limbs together with the one, stretching and relaxing around the pivots, it might allow the body to bend and extend, while the flesh would serve as a defense against heat and a shield against cold, and further, as a protection against falls, like felted furnishings, yielding softly and gently to bodies, and having warm moisture within itself, sweating in summer and being moistened from without, it would provide a coolness proper to the whole body, while in winter, by means of this same fire, it would ward off, in due measure, the frost that approaches and surrounds it from outside. Having thought all this through concerning us, the modeler in wax mixed and fitted together water and fire and earth, and mingling into them a ferment compounded of sour and salt, formed flesh, juicy and soft, and the nature of the sinews he blended from bone and unfermented flesh into a single substance midway in power between the two, using a yellow color for it. This is why sinews came to have a power more taut and sticky than flesh, but softer and moister than bone. With these the god wrapped round the bones and the marrow, binding them to one another with sinews, and afterward overshadowed all of them from above with flesh. Those bones that had the most soul in them he fenced with the least flesh, while those with the least soul within he covered with the most and densest flesh. And indeed at the joints of the bones, wherever reason did not show any necessity requiring it, he grew only a scant covering of flesh, so that the bodies would not be made unwieldy by flesh getting in the way of the bending of the joints, being thereby hard to move, nor again, where flesh was abundant and dense and packed tightly together, that it should, through its solidity, produce insensibility and make the parts concerned with thought duller and less retentive of memory. For this reason, the thighs and shins and the region around the hips and the bones of the upper arms and forearms and all our other joint-free parts and whatever bones within us are empty of intelligence for want of soul in the marrow, all these have been filled out with flesh. But the parts that have intelligence received less flesh, unless some part was constructed to have flesh purely for the sake of sensation on its own account, as with the form of the tongue. Otherwise the rule holds generally, for a nature that comes to be and grows by necessity, nowhere admits both dense bone and abundant flesh together, with keen sensation. The structure around the head would have had all these most of all, if the two could have come together at once, and the human race, having a fleshy, sinewy, and strong head set upon it, would have gained a life twice as long and many times over, and healthier and less painful than the life we have now. But as it was, the craftsmen responsible for our coming to be, weighing whether they should make a longer-lived but worse race or a shorter-lived but better one, agreed that a shorter but superior life was in every way to be chosen over a longer but inferior one for every creature. That is why they did not cover the head with dense bone or with flesh and sinews, since it has no joints. For all these reasons, then, the head, once attached to the body of every man, is more richly endowed with sensation and intelligence, but far weaker than the rest of the body. And it was for these reasons, and in this way, that the god set the sinews at the outer end around the head, glued them in a ring about the neck through their likeness to one another, and bound the extremities of the jaws to them beneath the shape of the face. The rest he scattered among all the limbs, joining joint to joint. As for the power of our mouth, those who arranged it fitted out teeth, tongue, and lips, as they are now arranged, for the sake both of necessities and of what is best, contriving the entrance for the sake of necessary things, and the exit for the sake of the best things. For everything that enters, giving nourishment to the body, is necessary, while the stream of speech that flows out and serves thought is the finest and best of all streams.